they use Owen Cares. It's sort of a house logo.
Well, when I got into the chemicals division, and then I got up here in 83 and we were having turmoil, I finally sat back one day and I said, Owen Cares about what? Well, I really couldn't put my finger on what the hell Owen Cares about what. And I had just been down to a course at University of Virginia on managing change given by Alec Horniman, who was an incredible person. I went down there figuring I'd learn about how I'm going to change everything. What I learned is I'm going to have to change myself. I spent three days down there, and it was probably three of the best days I ever spent. But I felt so strongly, I had Horniman come in and start working with our senior management about Owen Cares, Cares About What, and trying to establish some touchstones that our people could understand and affiliate with. And we came up with sort of what we call the Owen Moral Rock. Owen cares about promise keeping, and Owen cares about those kinds of things. And frankly, had we not done that, had we not put that platform in, we would have had a hell of a time putting in our quality program, because we built it off that foundation. So again, it's interesting that when you think about things that come through your mind that you're not necessarily always can see the ultimate vision out here. You know you've got to get somewhere. And it's mostly important to get started on something. And classically, this vision out here was a stronger, better, smarter company. But it was fuzzy. Over here was, Owen cares about what? So we put the so-called Owen Morrow Rock in place about promise-keeping and truth-telling. And then right on the heels of that came our quality program. And the quality program was built on those criteria. And had we not had that, we couldn't have done the quality program. And then, of course, came responsible care from CMA. This whole issue of womb-to-tomb management of chemicals, opening our plants to the public. Had we not had that moral foundation, and had we not had the quality effort going, we couldn't have managed the responsible care piece. So you come across these journeys, and intuitively, you recognize some needs and you try to do something about it. And most interestingly, it leads you to another place. And you look back 2 years from now and say, Jesus Christ, it's a damn good thing we did this here, because we'd still be floundering around here hadn't we done that. So it isn't necessarily serendipity. Some of it has to do with being a little perceptive about what you see as a current need. Not being sure what the future need is, but capitalizing on the effort from the current need that leads you somewhere that you can build on. So those were very, very important lessons learned as we came through this track.
You've been emphasizing the changes in management agendas that were an outgrowth of concerns about the productivity of the company.
Right.
Were there any management agenda changes as a result of other influences, such as environmental concerns or governmental relations?
Sure. There were several. If you look at the environmental side of it, it was almost sort of a hobby of plant managers. They just sort of had it as a tag on responsibility if it happened to be on site. And we had, let's call them abandoned or closed sites, scattered all over the place that nobody had any responsibility for. They just sort of sat out there. And of course, as the hysteria grew, and as we kept getting more and more requests from EPA on this and that, we didn't really have an organization to deal with it. So we frankly had to build and reorganize ourselves to manage our environmental legacy, and more importantly, to make damn sure we didn't create any new ones. So we really had to take people out of engineering, out of R&D. We took some guys out of even sales and marketing and got them involved in community affairs and the whole thing. So there really was an enormous focus on getting our hands around this environmental issue and managing it as effectively as we could, with the object
of being as good a citizen as we could be and spending money at the proper rate. Our major issue was, you know, if people weren't threatened, why the hell were we spending all this damn money trying to do something on the other side of the coin if there was any issue with respect to threat? We jumped right on top. About that time, I became president of Chemical Manufacturers Association, and of course I was up to my eyeballs in responsible care. And we were moving along inside Olin probably ahead of the curve because of that experience. I was in that CMA chair slot for 3 or 4 years, and so I think I, like many members that were serving on the CMA board, had a lot more insight to this tidal wave that was coming at us than a lot of people that hadn't been that active. And so we were organizing to deal with that and to bring into play the concepts of responsible care and product stewardship, forming community liaison public teams that come in, and we've made great progress there. So I feel very good about that.
Tell us a little bit about what responsible care as a program consists of. It grew out of the CMA.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, the history, of course, most people know is it started in Canada under the Canadian Manufacturers Association. And because so many of those Canadian assets are owned by American companies, many of the American companies became aware that there was a program up there. And the board of CMA started to look at what that was about and quickly believed that it was the right track, in a sense, if we were going to enjoy the public franchise we've had, we would have to operate differently in the future than we had in the past. And we felt that the concept of responsible care would enable us to keep our franchise. The industry was held in low esteem, and that esteem was dropping like a rock. There were all sorts of problems hither and yon. And we really needed to have something to help people help themselves. We put together these teams of code writers, a variety of people from a variety of companies, to work on things like product stewardship, start to formulate codes that companies could measure themselves against, started to offer benchmark opportunities, started this issue of public outreach in terms of forming community awareness organizations. CARE, Community Awareness Emergency Response, was probably, again, like I said, in the terms of the moral rock and the quality program, was sort of the start of that. Having an ability for the community to understand how to respond to a chemical spill or a chemical episode. Training the fire and the police organizations, and then opening your plants up, letting these people in. We were starting to do that at about the time we saw responsible care as a much more broader umbrella kind of a program. I don't think the chemical industry could survive today if we didn't have responsible care coming. I think we would have gotten very much like the atomic energy business. We would have been controlled so damn much it would have stunted our growth. And I mean, you got to remember, for the last several years, this industry has had the biggest surplus trade balance of any other industry in America, including aircraft and agriculture. And if we stifle it, we hand it over to the Europeans, we hand it over to the Asians. And I think from a self-preservation standpoint, we just got smart and said, we got to do something about what we're doing. And rather than just bitching about every environmental regulation that gets passed and screaming about every new rule, I said, let's get involved in the process. Let's see if we can help people understand through good science what works and what doesn't work. It hasn't been easy. It's cost a lot of money. But our plants as an industry, and certainly Olin's plants as a company, are in far superior shape than they were prior to bringing this kind of a concept to bear. The most difficult part of it is product stewardship. This is the womb to tomb thing. I mean, we've had to discontinue shipping customers because they don't handle stuff right. We've done that. We just said, You know, we've tried to get in there, you try to train them, and then you go back and check and find out that they're sloppy, and at some point you just say, we just can't take the risk of putting our product in your place if you're going to mishandle it. And of course, that's the ultimate test to be able to do that. Frankly, I'll have to say, where we've had that kind of a problem, we had it with one major chemical company, small plant, unnamed. And we were at the point of getting ready to cut off, and we were the only supplier of the product. And they finally woke up and said, you know, you just can't do that. And we said, well, we sure as hell can if you don't handle this stuff right. So we finally got high enough in the organization for somebody to wake up and say, wait a second, let's step back, let's look at what we're doing. Now let's get serious about training, let's get serious about getting the job done right. We got a happy customer, but it took, we had to get beyond the plant manager. He just, wasn't important for him. So that's a significant part of it.
It sounded though the key is getting the top management committed and involved.
No question. You know, and it's the classic, I always said when I was CEO over those 10 years, you know, everything's important. The CEO has to endorse everything. You know, after a while, your plate gets a damn full, you can't remember your name. But in truth, if the organization doesn't feel that top management commitment, it doesn't get done.
Did you have any particular selling job about environmental concerns to the Olin Board of Directors to commit the amount of funds required to...
I think, first of all, as we began to really cost out what the future looked like, the board just got scared, got frightened. They just couldn't believe the enormity of the potential spending that might be involved. I had been talking to them and telling them, you know, this goddamn thing is expensive. And we finally put a system in that started to grade out what our costs were, because we needed to do it to try to develop insurance recoveries, both from Lloyd's and from the domestic insurer. And because the parameters on these numbers were enormous, you know, you could say a minimum of and a maximum of. The maximum number just scared the hell out of the board. But once we got them back and said, look, what we're really trying to do is to define some parameters, and now we're going to try to refine to determine really what the most likely cases are. The board was very supportive. They knew that, because again, I was having that CMA experience, I was telling them about that. They realized that you had to do what you had to do. We never really balked, but we sure as hell did scare them. And that wasn't all bad. Once they really had gotten a little bit frightened, they began to want to know more about it. So as a result, we started reporting to the board twice a year, full board level, on our environmental spending programs. We report on the number of current sites, the current rate of spending, the anticipated spending for the next three-year period, and we line out some of our major successes and failures. We tell them about both, because we've had both kinds. So the board is very, very much involved in the process. It's a good question. But they had to get frightened a little bit first.
Do you regard this as just the cost of doing business now?
Yeah, it is the cost of doing business. It's a hidden tax, if you will, because everybody's doing it. But the thing that bothers me, I've been very, very active on Superfund reform. It was sort of my banner crusade. I got involved in it when I was chairman of CMA, and then I became a member of the Business Roundtable, and I chaired the Superfund committee at the Superfund Reform Committee of the Business Roundtable. The one thing that Superfund law does, it distributes these costs on an unequitable basis. If you happen to be a very old company, you have the burden. If you're a new company, you don't have the burden. This issue of retroactivity is absolutely, in my mind, illegal and immoral. To be able to go back and say you did something legally at the time with the best knowledge and now say, oh, that's too bad, you go out and clean it up. That drops the cherries in a very random fashion. As I said earlier, I think we have, as a percent of sales, a very high environmental load because we're in DDT, we're in hard pesticides, we've been mercury problems. So I do think that
a law like that could literally, if not managed properly, destroy a $5 billion corporation. It could just consume your assets. We've seen it in asbestos. We've seen it with Asbestos. We've seen it with Johns Manville. And the damn legislators don't give a damn. They just figure you're going to make the problem go away. You know, you got to remember, the very first Superfund law was passed in a lame duck session of Congress, surrounded by the hysteria of Love Canal. And the Congress figured, well, there's probably 25 or 30 of these sites around. So they put in a very, very stringent law. And then the regulators go out and start to regulate. And I mean, it gets worse and worse and worse. So I've been working like mad to try to get joint, several, and retroactive removed from the Superfund law, because it is really unfair and it's un-American. Whether we'll get there with this term of Congress or not, I don't know. But it's, I found, frankly, I was spending, as a CEO, probably 30 to 40% of my time on environmental issues. Particularly in the public forum, because that's where you're going to get it changed. And you kind of wonder about whether you can spend that kind of time. But I said to the board, I said, you know, if we don't get this changed, this could consume the whole damn company. It's the most important thing I could do. And after I spent some time educating him, they said, you know, you better get out. Do as much as you can on that arena while trying to manage the environmental impact back on the balance sheet and inside the company.
As you're spending so much time on environmental issues, are you getting any particular information flow from the scientist in the organization to help you understand the science involved, or is your involvement altogether management?
Well, more of the science part is being done collectively. You know, chlorine has been under attack. So the Chlorine Council was formed of all the major producers and the major consumers. And they're doing endocrine mimicking studies. It's very, very difficult for one company to do these kinds of broad things. So under the umbrella of CMA, under a ChemStar program, we brought this together where the Dows and the Oxys and the Olins can pool their resources to do more effective research. So that's one of the things that's happening. But there are development kind of activities that go on inside the company in terms of finding better ways to remediate and manage. So we have done some of that. A lot of it tends to be employed from outside. I'm just trying to think now of a couple of particular cases where we've done some things inside. You know, you get involved in these rods that the Federales put out from the EPA, and we learned a very expensive lesson, and one that we, this is where you're in the front end, where we didn't manage it. And we didn't pay a hell of a lot of attention to it. The next thing, we got a rod that was onerous, and it was up in Ohio. And we spent a fortune amount of money. It should never have been spent that way. But it taught us the next time around, we would manage the rod process. Right now, we have a case pending in the state of Alabama, in the federal court, to eliminate Superfund on the basis it's unconstitutional. Judge Hand, Learned Hand, ironically, this is what the third, you've heard about him, I'm sure. He's a maverick judge. We went in to settle a rod for McIntosh, where we have a plume, not moving off the property, but it was programmed to remediate. And we had battled with EPA for years about getting this damn thing settled. So we finally came to an agreement. They have to be sanctioned by the court. So they came beforehand, and we laid out this consent order that we were agreed to sign. I said, wait a minute. I want to study this. Please come back and see me next week. He came back next week and he said, I believe this is unconstitutional. He said everything I see about joint, several, and retroactive just flies in the case of the Constitution. And he said, I recognize there have been other courts that looked at this matter. But anyway, to make a long story short, we got forced into a combat with EPA. Because the judge would not let us sign a consent decree. So how that's all going to come out, I don't know whether there's been a final judgment on that or not. It's hard to say, but at least periodically you do run into a different situation like that. In the meantime,
Because we're responsible. We're proceeding with the remediation as it was outlined in the consent order, although the consent order wasn't signed or sanctioned, because we still think it's probably the right thing to do. We're not arguing with it. The judge was saying, how can the federal government inside the state of Alabama dictate a cleanup process where it's not contiguous or involved with navigable waters? He said it's unconstitutional. So you do run into some kind of weird ones from time to time.
What's Poland's situation and your management situation with respect to global business?
Well, once again, we're in the process of downsizing. We have just spun off, as I said earlier, our defense and aerospace business, which was a $500 million business. And we have just sold our toluene diisocyanate, aliphatic diisocyanate business to Arco Chemical for an enormous amount of money. And I would say right now the company is in a period of redesigning its strategy. We have never been a major international player, but we've had a lot of operations outside the United States, predominantly joint ventures. We've had three joint ventures in Japan. They're still operating. We have had a joint venture in Venezuela, which we now own and operate. We had a joint venture with Ciba Geigy on our electronic business, and we bought that out. We are investing heavily globally in our electronic chemical business. We built a new plant at Zwijndrecht near Antwerp to handle our photoresist. That's being expanded now to put in process chemical capabilities. Our feeling in electronic chemicals, where we really are the dominant player, that we want to be able to deliver the same product to IBM in Europe, in the United States, or Japan. And we want to be able to deliver it to them within a half an hour. That means you've got to have multiple capabilities of R&D, you've got to have some science capability, you've got to have technical centers with steppers that can manage this kind of stuff. So we are putting money into global expansion of our electronic chemical business. On the other side of the coin, we have been aggressively expanding in chloralkali, which we see for us as a domestic business. We don't think that business is something we want to do outside our boundaries. We just acquired the other half of our Niachlor joint venture with DuPont in Niagara Falls, and we're building a 250,000 ton a year, going to 400,000 ton a year chloralkali plant at McIntosh in a joint venture with Geon. Now that's a business that requires very little R&D, and it's domestic business. On the other side of the coin, our biocides business is a global business. That's zinc-olmidine based predominantly, which is the active ingredient Head and Shoulders anti-dandruff shampoo. We supply about 95% of Procter & Gamble's worldwide demand for that. They have a major inquiry out with us right now to build a facility in China, to expand our facilities in Ireland and Rochester, and hopefully we'll get that wrapped up. That's a significant growth business for us. And that particular molecule is very interesting because it also is being used in antifungal ship bottom paints, a whole variety of things. Putting it in the plastic on shower curtains so they don't mildew. So I would say that our focus will be on where we can take our businesses, not expand globally for the sake of being outside. And that's pretty much the way we've operated. We've operated by saying, you know, what's important for our business? If it's important for our business to be in Japan, we'll be in Japan. The three joint ventures are very successful. It's important for our business to be in Europe, we'll be in Europe. But we don't start by saying we got to be in Europe, we got to be in Japan. We come through the kind of core business philosophy and look about where we need to be from a product delivery to our customer standpoint.
You referred earlier to R&D and that you have some D plants and some R plants. In the research emphasis, is it on new product or is it on better ways to do the same product?
I think my experience in this company has been more on the latter. Better ways to produce it. Better ways to focus on waste reduction. How can you make this product with producing less waste? We came up with an absolutely new process to make dinitrotoluene, the lead product for TDI at Lake Charles, Louisiana. Historically, we've always bought DMT from our products. But our guys came up with a product that eliminates the sac plant, which means you don't have any residual sulfuric acid waste that you have to deal with. It's very significant because in the manufacture of DDT, probably the sac operation represents 25 to 30% of the cost. If you can take that sac operation out, you significantly drop the cost of DDT. That was jointly done by our research people at Cheshire, more the R side, and the development people at Lake Charles. And it's now culminated in the fact that we're building a plant, which we just sold, but the picture's there, at Lake Charles to supply DMT to our TDI plant. If the plant is successful, Air Products will buy it. It will be their plant. We would prefer to have them be our supplier. And we will license that technology only for our own use. We won't make it available to our competitors at this stage of the game, maybe in 5 or 7 years. But anyway, ARCO has bought that business. But it's a point about how we were operating. There's pretty good interaction between the D sites, the development sites, and the Cheshire Research Laboratory. And Cheshire, of course, has the broad spectrum of analytical capability that many of the D sites don't have, so a lot of that work has to be done.
In that context, what do you think is particularly important from your point of view as a manager for the future vitality of chemical innovation?
Well, I think there's no single answer, but I think it's the answer is somewhat broader spectrum. First of all, I think we have got to figure out how to make product with less waste. Historically, the chemical industry in the plant environment has always looked at positive productivity programs. If you reduce waste, you can help your costs. But now that's being driven more by the environmental side. I think that, I was thinking about this last night coming to this meeting. What was the chemical industry like when you started, and what's it like now? When I first started, it was pressure and temperature, and catalysis was just starting. You know, the shift catalyst, I guess, had come in the late 40s, maybe. Now we see this issue of catalysis as being a significant way to bend molecules as opposed to pressure and temperature alone. And I think the next wave is going to be genetic. And I think we're going to see more over time of molecule bending genetically. And that may also, as we look out 20 or 30 years, be very interesting because it may also have less waste. I see, just saw an announcement that Monsanto's looking to buy Celgene. Again, just looking at, now they're also in the pharmaceutical business, so they see a wrap there. But I think we're going to see more biochemistry involved, if you want to not call it genetic, but biochemistry involved. You know, you used to make citric acid and oxalic acid and things like that. probably a biochemistry back years ago, and there wasn't much done, but I think we're going to see more of that in the future.